From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. How's the line go? It comes in many names. The plague, the crisis, the, what was it?
I think I called it the walking plague.
Yes. The opening lines from the terrific novel, World War Z, my guest, who I think is uniquely qualified to write about institutions in denial of crisis, Max Brooks. He, of course, we know him from Zombie Guide to the Apocalypse. His new book, sitting right in front of me, is The Evolution. But the book we're going to, and of course, World War Z, but the book we're going to talk about today, and a book that sends chills through me every time I pick it up, is the graphic novel, Germ Warfare, A Very Graphic History. Max Brooks, thanks for coming back.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
But before we get into all these things, let's talk about your writing for a second, because almost nobody ever does.
Sure.
And you do have this affinity for, even in Harlem Hellfire, it's identifying institutions that are incapable of seeing what's in front of them. Where does that come from for you?
I write about adaptation and adaptation trying to survive, because that was my life. I think on a very personal level, growing up with dyslexia, what was hard for me was easy for everyone else. So I had to adapt. You know, back in the 80s, the system was set up for kids who were good on standardized tests that were timed. That was it. I wasn't. So I had to develop coping mechanisms. I had a family that had to cope. You know, my parents, Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, when you're in show business, you're living project to project. So you're always having to adapt. You're always having to strategize. You can't just lock into a job and do it for 20 years and get a retirement package at the end of it. So adaptation was always part of my life.
But too, I mean, and when you're talking about being dyslexic, and especially in the 80s, there was an entire institutional lack of recognition of that.
Oh, yeah.
And inability to deal with it and lack of empathy towards it.
I might have gotten kind of a 1-2 punch, because I think when you're the child of celebrities, there's also a sense that you're lazy. And I don't think that was the case in all my teachers. I think in all honesty, most of my teachers probably just didn't know about dyslexia and just didn't understand it. But I do think there were a couple that had it in their mind that, well, this kid's got rich and famous parents, so clearly he thinks he can screw around and not do the work.
And what you do so well is both in sort of, I think, in dramatic and really in historical terms, detail these lacks and this kind of these walls that exist. And it feels like it's something that you like to deal with both in sort of literal and metaphoric terms, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm always dealing about sort of what can go wrong, because what I'm trying to do a lot with my writing is get people out of the poles of denial and panic. Because in between those two, there is a rational, safe middle ground of education. And unfortunately, we ping pong as a society between denial and between panic. And I'm hoping that we can get out of that.
What's so interesting and great about German Warfare, A Very Graphic History, a great title, by the way, is to be confronted with how far back the concept of German warfare goes.
Yes. Germ warfare basically traces the history of how we as a species have used germs to hurt each other.
And also weirdly about the recognition of science. That as science rises, so do the possibilities of inflicting more harm on a greater scale.
Yes. Even before we knew about germs, we knew about disease. And we knew where they came from, so we tried to use it to hurt, like the ancient Greeks, using arrows dipped in feces. Or the Mongols catapulting plague bodies over walls.
Or William Trent.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's a very famous one, is giving smallpox blankets to Native Americans. However, the real tragedy of that was it didn't really work, because the Native Americans already had smallpox. That's the real darkest chapter of that story. And then science comes along, and then we start to understand that these microscopic life forms are the things that are causing us to get sick. And as most people are trying to use that to help us, there's always a few out there that's saying, wait a minute, I can flip this, and I can use these germs to kill people.
It's interesting, too, because then that kind of offense, be it through the Japanese World War II or what the Russians did, becomes, in effect, kind of an institutional behavior itself, does it not?
Yeah. in this country, we don't know a lot about Japanese biological warfare programs. We know a lot about the Holocaust, but we don't know that on the other side of the world, the Japanese were building this massive military-industrial complex to experiment with every kind of microbe to see what they could do with it. And they used it. They used active germ warfare. They dropped plague bombs on China. They infected prisoners and sent them back into the population. They did everything possible to see what germs could do to bring China to its knees. And we still don't know the casualty rates because China locked up after World War II. So we still don't know. Estimates can put it anywhere between 100,000 and a million. We just don't know.
It's funny you mention that because China locking up is why we are where we are right now, isn't it?
And why World War Z got banned for that exact reason.
Oh, of course. Oh, my gosh. Of course it did.
Yeah. World War Z was banned in China.
By the way, I'm talking to the author of World War Z, and his new book is terrific, by the way, Germ Warfare, A Very Graphic History, is Max Brooks. What's fascinating to me, too, is that it becomes, for you, finally, it's drama in these things. In all these situations, you see drama in them, don't you?
Yeah, because it's history, for me, the reason I got excited for history when I was a kid was it's just stories. I once had a professor, a history professor, in my semester abroad at the University of the Virgin Islands. Professor Turnbull, who later became the governor of the VI, and he used to call history a life story of the human race. And to me, that typifies why I've always been fascinated by it.
But that interest in history clearly predated all of that, did it not?
Well, I grew up in a family of storytellers. And so my parents, particularly my mother, she didn't differentiate between fictional stories and real ones. She used to read to me real stories. She played Annie Sullivan. That was a real story. And her favorite book to read to me was a book called The Microbe Hunters.
Oh, my God. That book is terrifying.
It is terrifying. So, Sweet Dreams, 8-year-old Max, those were the stories read to me. But my mother told me these were stories of hope. These were stories where people had been dying and dying and dying. And instead of just, what medieval Europe used to do, pray, whip yourself, and kill the Jews, they started to invent science. And that started to help them actually combat these plagues.
I have to tell you, the name Van Leeuwenhoek never scared me until I read Germ Warfare, because he becomes the person who, by identifying this, really opens the door to where we are now.
Yeah, he was an astronomer in reverse. Instead of looking at the stars, he looked inward, and we actually got to see these microscopic creatures that we didn't know existed.
And by the way, initially, he was branded a heretic for that kind of behavior.
Oh, yeah, because before, it used to be called bad air. When I went to school in the Caribbean, I learned about how it was called the white man's graveyard. White people would go to the Caribbean, set up their plantations, and just die in droves because they had absolutely no idea that disease came from mosquitoes. They thought it was just bad air coming in, and so it was swamp air. They didn't know that the mosquitoes carried malaria, carried other diseases that would then kill them.
It's so interesting, too, because we talked about this a little bit the last time you were here, in World War Z, the idea of dealing with this kind of sort of institutional inertia and what disease can bring as metaphor was an interesting way to turn this thing into something that would connect for people en masse.
Yeah, because I think that's how human beings deal with any kind of crisis. It doesn't have to be disease. I think initially we have what's called an ego defense mechanism. We have this wall in our mind which wants to protect us from things that scare us into insanity. So we instinctively say, it's fine. It's fine. I'm going to be fine. And if you take that too far, you deny the facts and then you don't prepare. And then you tip over into panic. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And that is on an individual level. It's also on a societal level. And you see it. You saw it in the plague of my generation in AIDS. I can't get it. It's a gay disease. It's an IV drug user. It's Haitians, all that. And then suddenly we tipped over in the mid-80s to, oh my God, it's everywhere. It's on toilet seats. It's on cups. It's on doorknobs. And you have real stories about doctors not treating patients and about EMTs not treating car crash victims. Oh, I could get AIDS. And we knocked out AIDS with public education. There's still no cure. There's still no vaccine. But in the 1980s, we sent out the C. Everett Koop. Remember that Amish admiral looking guy? Surgeon General mailed out a pamphlet to every American household called Understanding AIDS. And that was the turning point. I remember having AIDS week at my school at Crossroads, where we learned about AIDS. Here's how it's transmitted. Here's how you can't get it. Here's how you can. And here's how you can stop from getting it. And that's how we as a nation beat AIDS, with education.
But that took two generations. That's, we're talking about 30 years of learned behavior.
It really did. It was a lot of initial panic and stigmatizing.
Well, dismissal, then panic.
Oh, dismissal, then panic, and huge stigmatizing. I don't remember. There was a comedian, Sam Kinison, who had a huge joke about basically saying, thanks, gay America, for giving us the black plague of the 80s. And then the whole crowd stood up and cheered. And then you have the final stage, which is forgetting. Because you think about SARS. You know, I wrote World War Z based on SARS. I was not looking forward. I would love to say that I predicted this, but no, I was talking about history. SARS had just happened. I modeled my zombie virus on that, assuming that we'd learned our lesson. And we hadn't. We forgot about it. We went back to making cheap iPhones in sweatshops in China. And now we are all paying the price.
Because obviously the almost a conditional reaction to pain is an impulse to forget. Yeah. This fascinates me because as a writer, you trade information and the way information is traded in really simple terms, and that people now have access to so much information, but they aren't absorbing it or being actually really selective about the information that they take in must be maddening to you.
What is so maddening about it is as much as I would love to simply wag my finger at China and say, you have a quasi-fascist government and you didn't tell your people the truth, we have different problems here. In China, people are getting sick because they don't know the truth. In America, we're getting sick because we don't care. Because we can surrender to apathy. Oh, I can't get it. It's not a big deal. Not a big deal. Or greed. Oh, hey, I don't want to cancel this giant convention or trade show because I'm going to lose a lot of money. We have misinformation. Oh, I've heard on this website that this famous Hollywood celebrity told me this healing crystal would work. In a democracy, we all have to be the leaders and we all have to grow up.
I just find, and I was thinking about specifically in World War Z, how your narrative basically goes from one institution to another, all of which ignore the truth. And given that there's so much science now, basically we communicate through science. Basically, science dictates almost every way, all the everyday details of our lives.
Yes.
Isn't it a little troubling to you that we still can make ourselves as ignorant, as willfully ignorant as we do?
I think certainly where science is concerned, we are the victims of our own success. Specifically when you think about anti-vaxxers. A generation ago, there were no anti-vaxxers because the grandparents were greatest generation. The grandparents had all grown up with horrific killing and crippling diseases. Now the grandparents are baby boomers. They grew up getting vaccinated. So they don't have that sense memory. They don't have that real deep, dark fear of what could be coming. So when their children say, I'm not going to vaccinate your grandchildren, they go, well, that's your choice. As opposed to a generation ago where those grandparents would have smacked you, you know, in the back of the head saying, are you crazy? You know, my mentor, I can't say his name because I haven't asked permission, but he's a very famous actor and writer, and he taught me how to write. And he's a family friend. We used to vacation together. And at this resort we'd all go to, in the 80s, they brought in a masseuse. And my mother said to him, oh, you've got to get a massage. Massages are wonderful. And he said, I don't like massages because they remind me of the physical therapy I had when I had polio. You don't hear those stories nowadays. This is not a common thing. You know, my doctor, he's an older gentleman, and he started in a residency for whooping cough. And he says, most people don't know what it's like to have to hold a child wheezing and coughing themselves literally to death. Those are things of the past.
I'm going to ask you to hold that on that optimistic note. We're going to take a break. Finished? Almost. My guest is Max Brooks. His newest project is Germ Warfare, A Very Graphic History. I'll explain that a little. Sober K in a moment. It's the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Finished? Almost. That is a recurrent line in the book, graphic novel, Germ Warfare, A Very Graphic History. Its author is my guest, Max Books. Because that's a great callback in the book, isn't it?
Yes. And I should preface by saying the book is not for profit.
But by the way, tell people how they can get the book.
Yes. All right. It's harder to get the book. You can't get it on Amazon because it is not for profit. Go to, I guess, my Twitter page, Max Brooks Author, and you can download it for free. And the reason it's free is because it comes to you through a biodefense panel, the Blue Ribbon Biodefense Panel. This is a non-government agency with Tom Ridge and Joe Lieberman and Donna Shalala.
When I saw that list of people, that really is sort of like the Justice League of people not liking each other.
It really – these people do not agree on anything except keeping us safe from germs because guess what? The germs don't care how we vote. Germs don't care about what political party or God you pray to or what bathroom you feel comfortable using. The germs do care if the bathroom is hygienic. And that's what these people are trying to do because they're getting us ready for the next phase of germ warfare. And that day is coming very quickly. What I mean is, up till a few years ago, if you wanted to release a biobomb, you know, a plague bomb, you had to have a PhD and you had to have millions of dollars of lab equipment. Not anymore. We are getting to the phase where you can, as long as you know how to work a computer, you can download the genetic sequencing for free.
Well, as you did remind us in the book, is basically been barely 20 years since anthrax was mailed across this country.
And I have a very personal attachment to that because I was working in 30 Rock when the anthrax letters were
delivered. Gosh, you were there for NBC News.
Yes. I was there for Saturday Night Live. I was working for SNL.
Gosh.
I had just got the job. 9/11 happened. Terrible, scary. And I thought, well, at least that's the worst that can ever happen. And then we had anthrax in our building. And I wrote about this for an article about Zika. Remember, Zika's coming through. And Congress is dithering. And I said, wait a minute, you're spending trillions on these wars and this homeland security to protect us from a threat. And here's the threat. So what if Zika had been cooked up in a lab? Would you still be dithering? So I got a call from the biodefense panel saying, could you help us out? I went to their hearing on Capitol Hill. Good news, they're on it. They got the scientists, they got the doctors, they got the logisticians, they got the intel experts. What they didn't have was public outreach. I said, it doesn't matter if you have all this information if you can't communicate it to the voter who votes to raise taxes to fund these operations. You have to find a way to communicate. And so I pitched them the idea of a comic book because in my experience, comics are what particularly young people are reading voluntarily. And by the way, we used to do that. Our government used to produce comic books about everything to educate the public. I still have one written for Yugoslavia. Superman protects Bosnian kids from landmines and shows them how to identify landmines.
The landmines, yes.
Yeah. I've got all these comics.
I've got one of the Batman does the very same thing.
Yeah, see? We used to be so good at that, and we need to get back to communicating that way.
I guess this is what's so interesting, too, is that this was published so recently, last summer, that you were able to, in a panel, sort of remind us that the CDC cuts go back a little ways.
Yes, we cut. When I visited the CDC, when World War Z had come out, they told me their funding was cut by a third, particularly overseas intel gatherers. These are no different than CIA folks that go around the world. These are people that go everywhere into villages, into jungles, and try to identify emerging pathogens and sound the alarm. And we're cutting that. And to me, that would be like if you tried to cut our early warning radar stations on the eve of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's the same thing.
It's interesting, too, because I guess we think that, again, the CDC cuts are a recent thing. They go back. I mean, in fact, the unfortunate thing that this book can remind us of is that these things we're talking about all have historical precedents. And again, it's that institutional inability to profit from its mistakes.
Yes. This is the problem is we have a crisis, we deal with it, and then unfortunately we tend to forget. And that's why the role of historians is so important, not just to remind us, but to remind us in a way we can understand. And I remind my fellow historians, don't get too academic, don't get too much into the weeds. Find ways to communicate in ways that we can all understand and be interested. Tell stories.
Well, that's the unfortunate thing is that our president has a gift for the off-the-cuff anecdote.
Yes.
That feels like it has weight because he's a performer.
Right. And we tend to degrade him for that. But the truth is, that's how leaders are supposed to communicate. You know, FDR was the same way. He sold us on lend-lease by saying, listen, if my neighbor's house is on fire, I loan him my garden hose. He puts the fire out so the fire doesn't spread to my house. Then I get the hose back.
Well, JFK, I am a donut.
Boom. Yes. I am a Berliner. It's so, you have to communicate in very simple ways. That's not talking down. That's talking plain.
Which is, again, one of the things that's so terrific about World War Z and all your work, and it connects to this as well, is your understanding for how simplicity can be basically a foundation of storytelling.
It doesn't have to be overly complex. And that's why I believe that storytelling is a way to educate, because it puts you in the shoes of someone that you've never lived in. And it makes you empathize. And that's why I get very angry when I hear about writers being censored because they're not of the tribe that they're writing about, which I think is ridiculous. I think if Spike Lee wants to tell a Holocaust story, he's one of the best filmmakers ever, go for it. Or if Ava DuVernay wants to do something about interning Japanese Americans, go for it. Tell a great story. It's the message, not the messenger.
Those finally optimistic words come from my guest, Max Brooks. His newest project, of course, is German Warfare. Actually, his newest project, which he should be on the road promoting right now and has not, and he's generously given me a copy of, his new book is De-Evolution, which sounds like it could be a title of anything you've ever written, as a matter of fact.
Yes, and this is the crazy irony. De-Evolution is a Bigfoot book. It's a high-tech, high-end eco-community. It's in the wilderness. It's utopia. Then it gets cut off by Mount Rainier erupting, which can really happen. I did a lot of real research with the USGS about this. Told a real story.
We've certainly seen volcanoes in Washington State.
Oh, yeah. And Rainier could actually blow.
It really could.
It really could, and it could be devastating. In fact, I have a map up in my office of where the volcano would blow and who would be affected, and that was my guide for writing the book. So I write this elaborate book, and I use Bigfoot as a way to draw people in. And as the ultimate irony, I can't go up to the Pacific Northwest now to promote it. I can't go to Bigfoot's house to promote a Bigfoot book because Washington State has a state of emergency.
And that line, or that couplet rather, finished almost. I mean, it becomes, it takes on this kind of both horrific and comic, if you pardon the expression, import in the story, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, we're never done. We're always moving forward, and we have to be careful not to slide back. This is what's so scary about anti-vaxxers. We're starting to see diseases crop up that we thought we had beaten. But unless they're absolutely 100% eradicated, the monsters are always lurking in the darkness, and we got to make sure to always keep the lights on.
And now all these things that we were told maybe 15 years ago were going away, like measles, like polio, whooping cough, are all reemerging.
Oh, polio is in a part of the world that very well-to-do people from Santa Monica love to go hiking and ashramming in. And if there was ever a vector, that's how polio is going to come back. They're going to go to those parts of the world and find themselves. They're also going to find polio. And then they're going to bring it back to us. Thank you very much.
I guess I find myself thinking about, as you were talking about your family history, you know, your father is somebody else who took dystopia and made fun of it, but to remind us that it was only a heartbeat away if we weren't paying attention.
Right. Comedy is a wonderful way to talk about real issues, because if you beat them over the head too much with a lecture, you trigger the ego defense mechanism. You don't want to bore them. You don't want to scare them. Tell them a great story or make them laugh. I learned more about basic economics from that one Chris Rock joke. I'm not talking about rich, I'm talking about wealthy, than I did in a whole semester in college of political economy. When Chris Rock broke it down to rich versus wealthy, Shaq is rich. The white man who signs his paycheck, that's wealthy. Boom. I mean, I learned more from Richard Pryor and from Lenny Bruce and from Dick Gregory than I did in probably half of those professors that I ever saw.
I imagine you must have learned from Richard Matheson too, though.
Oh my God, Richard Matheson, I Am Legend.
I can't pick up anything you've ever written and not think about the first page of I Am Legend.
Yeah. No. When it comes to me and George Romero and anything, plague or horror, you know, we might be students of the Bible, but Gutenberg, the guy who actually got to mass produce it, you know, that's Richard Matheson.
But, I mean, again, I was thinking about the walking plague. That could be a line from any of Matheson's, especially from Iron Legend. But also that idea, and it's something that we're seeing happening in real time. That's why to have you come on and talk about this, and thank you for being so generous in doing it, is to say that these kinds of plagues are visited on every day. They're part of the quotidian world. They're not just part of some weird sci-fi fantasy.
Yeah, this can be the problem if we don't learn from history. It's going to come back. And we've beaten back the monsters, but they're still alive. And so that's why it's so important to always be aware. And stories keep it in our consciousness. And we say, oh, well, I read this somewhere. This feels more real to me now.
But by making everything you do geopolitical, and that even depends to you know how much I love Harlem Hellfighters. Even part of that, I mean, the fact that you cannot extricate these things, but you can use, I think, bold and unsettling ways to tell stories. And part of your ethos as a storyteller has to be you want to sort of catch people off guard a little bit, don't you?
Well, yeah, because I want to show that everything is connected. Nothing exists in its neat little box. You know, public health does not exist in a little box. Public health is part of politics, as we've seen, which is also part of national security, which is also part of economics, as we're seeing. You know, for many years, we invested in China because we thought, capitalism needs stability, right? You're not going to have a coup. You're not going to have a war. You're not going to have a revolution. You're not even going to go on strike. Yay, China, stability. But at no point did we ask them, hey, how you doing with horrible plagues? And by how you doing, I don't just mean, do you have enough doctors and hospitals? If a doctor does sound the alarm, are you going to shut him down? And look at what's happening now. We might be on the verge of another recession. Simply because public health let us down.
And greed, as you were mentioning.
And greed. We didn't invest in public health. Here in the West, cutting the CDC, cutting doctors, you know, not making sure that the average citizen is well cared for, because a healthy citizenry is a productive citizenry.
Well, when you have an administration that's fighting Saddam Hussein at the same time, cutting CDC,
yeah.
I mean, it's, again, just pulling all these things together must drive you a little bit crazy.
You know, I think I was crazy to begin with, and this makes me sane. You know, what I like to think about, I go in what I call my mother's Africa model. When I was a kid, right out of college, I worked for the BBC as a field researcher. And part of that field research was in Africa. 1994, Rwanda's going on, Ebola's going on, Somalia's going on. My mother freaking out. But instead of going to church, she went to the World Atlas and she became an Africa geography expert. And she read the newspaper about what was happening in Africa, and then she would find those names, you know, in the New York or LA Times and put them on the map. So when I would write her a postcard, hey, Mom, I'm here, I'm in Kampala, she would find Kampala on the map and be like, oh, no revolution, no genocide, no Ebola, my boy is fine. So knowledge kept her sane, and that's what I do. By researching this, by writing about it, it actually takes away the anxiety.
It's interesting, too, because you must find yourself in the position where people are responding first and foremost to the kind of horror that these things bring up, and then they get around to saying, it's a great story.
I think it's very similar to when a good stand-up comedian tells a good joke. You laugh, and then on the drive home, you say, wow, I really have to think about what they meant by that. And it's the same thing. You know, if I walk into a room and now, if I said, what would you do in a quarantine? Now people would listen. A year ago, if I had said that, I'd clear the room. But if I go into a room and say, hey, how would you guys prepare for a zombie plague? Then we'd get in a great discussion about bottled water and about protection methods. That's why the CDC had a zombie plan. It was so brilliant. They were talking about a quarantine plan. But you wrap it in the metaphor of zombies, suddenly it's safe and it's fun and it's educating.
Except people didn't seem to take away that basic lesson of be prepared, which is what they were trying to say in that.
Right. Well, hopefully enough people did, but that zombie plan should have been in every household.
Well, we're out of time. My guest who scares me way more than he should be able to is Max Brooks. His newest project is Devolution, which I guess I'll read and have him come back to talk about, if you wouldn't mind.
You bet.
But in the meantime, how do people get Germ Warfare? Let them know.
Germ Warfare. Go to my Twitter page, Max Brooks Author, and you can download it for free.
That's where I first read it. Our recording engineer here in NPR West is Patrick Murray. The show is mixed and edited by Kat Ure. I'm going to go wash my hands. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.